Hola, bonjour, hello. Let me ask you a question. Do you think it's possible to have a world language class where instead of teaching the language, the rules, and the vocab, you and your students use the language to enjoy learning about each other and the world? I hope your answer is a big yes, because that's exactly what you will discover inside Growing with Proficiency, the podcast. My name is Claudia Elliott, a Spanish teacher born and raised in Colombia, who is as passionate as you are to support our learners to grow in their proficiency and cultural competence. My goal is that in this podcast you find clarity, strategies, ideas, and inspiration that you can bring into your classroom the next day. Are you ready? Get comfortable while I grab my cafecito colombiano and let's start this conversation now. Hola, bonjour, hello. Welcome to a new episode of Growing with Proficiency, the podcast where we explore all the aspects related to language acquisition and teaching. I am your host, Claudia Elliott, and today we're joined by a guest who truly needs no introduction in the world of language education, Dr. Bill Van Patten. Dr. Van Patten's work has been a cornerstone in the field of language acquisition, and his insights have been instrumental in shaping the approach to teaching of many language teachers like me. I still remember listening over and over many of his podcast episodes from Tea with BVP and Talking L2 with BVP, and it's an absolute honor to have him here. Dr. Bill Van Patten has made outstanding contribution to the world of second language acquisition and instruction. He has written many, many books, including The Nature of Language, Language in a Nutshell, and While We're in the Topic. He has also written nearly 200 articles and book chapters. After leaving the academia in 2018, Dr. Bill Van Patten has pursued writing full-time, with his novels receiving many awards. Our talk today is going to focus on language acquisition. And because it's so powerful, I am dividing this conversation into two parts. In this first part, we're going to talk about the role of input in language acquisition, how language develops in our brains, and how we can measure language growth in a different way that aligns better with the nature of language. In the second part, next week, you're going to get to listen Dr. Bill Van Patten's insight about grammar instruction and the role of output. Get ready for an incredible conversation. So let's start it. Dr. Bill Van Patten, welcome to Growing with Proficiency, the podcast, and thank you so much for accepting my invitation.
Oh, Claudia, with pleasure. And first of all, thank you for that wonderful comment, those wonderful comments you made about your interest in SLA and listening to my podcast. And if I'm honest, I have to tell people I kind of miss doing those podcasts and those shows. I don't know if you remember, used to be call in. We did it live and people could call in, and then you could listen afterwards as a podcast if you wanted. And people would call in with all kinds of questions. It kept me on my toes, let me tell you. So I miss doing that. So good for you that you're doing this, Claudia.
I know. I decided to do it because it was safe. Like, I just didn't have to be there. I didn't have to travel, and I could put it and I could repeat it. Because let me tell you, I listened to so many of your episodes two times, three times, sometimes, because they're still air. They're still available, some of them. So I still go and listen to them. So yes, it was great. I listened to all of them. It was great. And I know that most of the world language teachers that are listening to this podcast right now know who you are, know your work, but I don't think many know how did you end up working in the field of second language acquisition. So how was that story? How did you start second language acquisition? I just love to hear how was that. It was meant to be. It was something all your life you knew that you were going to become a linguistic and do research in second language acquisition?
Actually, no. Interesting. I grew up with two languages. I always had a fascination with bilingualism and languages because I grew up in an English and Spanish speaking household, and I, in college, did not major. I went to a very small college. They didn't have such a thing as linguistics. I didn't know that the field existed. And I went to graduate school in Texas in Latin American studies. That's how I got started in graduate school. I didn't like the program I was in. I didn't like what I was studying, but I had a TA ship in Spanish to help pay for my graduate school. And so the person who was in charge of the language program that I was teaching in had observed me a couple of times and said, you know, you have a mind about languages and the way you look at the world and so on. Have you ever thought about linguistics? Because, you know, I was unhappy in the program I was in. And I was considering moving back to California and either going back to UCLA or someplace else and doing something different. And I said, no, what do you mean linguistics? He goes, well, why don't you stay? He goes, I'll help you switch your programs and then put you in some courses in the spring semester. So this was my first year in grad school. I'm like, okay. I took 3 linguistics courses. Within 2 weeks, I was hooked. It's no. Like, this is what I was meant to do. So I had a background in science. I always liked science. Okay. I actually started off in chemistry in college. That didn't last. But yeah. I always had that mind that likes to look at things in certain ways, right? Very linear, very logical, very data-driven, very empirical. And so when I started these courses in linguistics in my spring semester of my first year in graduate school, boom, I was hooked. And then I didn't even know language acquisition existed until I took a course as my second year in grad school. I took a course in the linguistics department in child language acquisition, which is my first course outside of the department of Spanish. And I went, oh, wow, this language acquisition stuff is neat. And so I took a total of 2 courses in child language acquisition, a couple of courses in psycholinguistics. And then I took 1 course in second language acquisition and I was off and running. And I was just, and of course, the rest of my coursework is, of course, all in linguistics. So anyway, so that's how it happened.
Interesting. But, you know, when I start listening to your podcast and I start listening, reading your work and, you know, reading your books, my kids were kind of like 5 and 6. So they were developing linguistically and they were bilingual because, you know, they were born here, but I talk to them in Spanish and my husband talks to them in English. So I could see, like, it was so neat for me to, like, see what was happening and, you know, the errors and all the things that you were mentioning. And I was like, oh, my gosh, why nobody told me this? And by then I was teaching for, like, 8 years Spanish. And I said, why nobody told me this? So I think second language acquisition, it is fascinating. One of the things that I decided to be super, I'm not a very... I don't take risk. I don't do anything that is out of the normal thing. So inviting you and send you that invitation was very daring to me. It's to my personality. I'm a very safe person. But I did it when I read a post that you wrote in Facebook. And I was saying, oh my gosh, it's just so clear. Like, I want to, like, create a billboard and put it out there for everybody to read. And it was this, and I'm going to read it. You said, a message for L2 folks. The role of communicatively embedded and comprehensible input is not a hypothesis in L2 acquisition. So let's stop calling it that. The fundamental role of input is a fact. And I want to talk about that. I want to talk because we keep talking about the research and the hypothesis and the thesis and the theory and all that. But more and more, I've been seeing that is a fact. So can you share with us how can we really grab our, and why we keep struggling with that fact, that comprehensible input, the role, the essential role of comprehensible input for L2 acquisition?
Okay. Let me make a blanket statement. Excuse me. Let me make a blanket statement about something that's, I think, relevant before I answer your question more directly. And that blanket statement is that second language acquisition, what it is, how it works, and so on, and the nature of language are the best kept secrets in language teaching. In teacher education programs, these are topics that at best are given a week or two. And then in professional development, we don't see anything about this at all. And even national organizations don't really do much to help promote basic knowledge about second language acquisition. I'm not talking about the intricacies and the minutiae that those of us who work in the field, when we try to research these tiny, tiny little details of things, I'm talking about that. But the basics of SLA, we have known now for 40 plus years. And why teachers don't know those things, I don't know. I always teach them. I've always been part of my teacher education programs and working with TAs and K through 9 through 12 teachers and so on. Okay, so that said, what has happened, I think, over the years, Claudia, is that there are a growing set of facts. And in fact, Michael Long published an article in 1990, I believe it was called. Yeah, 1990. It was called The Least a Theory of Second Language Acquisition Needs to Explain. And what he did in that article was list basic facts. By 1990, we know these things to be true. And one of them was the fundamental role of input. And since then, we've refined that list and so on. And when I did with Jessica Williams the theories book in the first edition of that book, it's now going into fourth edition, we took Michael Long's basic ideas. What are the basic facts of second language acquisition that need to be explained by any theoretical approach? And the first one we mentioned is the fundamental role of input. So this fact has been around. It's been a fact since at least the early 80s. It's been accepted as a fact. And just as a side note, I was corresponding with Steve Krashen not too long ago. And I said, hey, Steve, we got to stop calling this a hypothesis. Stop talking about the comprehension hypothesis. Stop talking about the input hypothesis. Stop talking about the fact. And he says, oh, Bill, that's a really good idea. So that's when I jumped on Facebook, Claudia, and put that post, because Steve and I had just been emailing each other back and forth about that. We need to get, in order for people to understand the fact of the fundamental role of input in language acquisition, teachers need to have some basic knowledge about second language acquisition. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it makes no sense. Because here's what happens. Here's my concern is that, and I've seen this happen for years now, if you don't understand how second language acquisition happens, if you don't understand about the nature of language, if you don't understand about the nature of communication and how all these things fit together, what you're going to do as a teacher, you're going to say, oh, okay, I know what I need to do now. I need to take input and teach the same old thing a new way. So I'm going to teach verb endings with input. I'm going to teach the past tense with input. I'm going to teach the food vocabulary with input, whatever it is that is in textbooks, people are gonna say input is a technique because they don't understand second language acquisition itself or the nature of language or the nature of communication. So to answer your question, there's much more than just knowing that the role of input is a fact. You have to couch it within a broader context of how does SLA work? How does language work? And how does communication work?
Yeah, absolutely. And talking about that, let's talk about the language, because we're language teachers. That's what we do. We are language teachers. We're teaching a language, but we just really don't know what language is. At least I didn't for many, many years. And I have to be honest with you. I have read your book, The Nature of Language, at least two times. And still, like my mind is kind of like, oh my goodness, because it's so complex. So I just quit and I say, I know that is not what I thought it was, and it's very complicated. I'm not going to worry more about it because I just try to articulate it, to explain it to other teachers. But I know the complexity is just beyond, like, it's like me trying to explain, I don't know, physics or, you know, like something that I'm not going to be able to articulate it in a you know, comprehensible way. So now that you're here, tell us a little bit about that, because as a language teacher, I think that is one of the essential points that at least we need to have clarity of what language is, or at least what language is not, and that what we think it was.
Okay. I'm going to get a little bit in the weeds here. I'm going to talk a little bit, so hopefully your listeners don't get tired of hearing my voice. And you feel free to interrupt me and make me slow down or take a break. But you've asked a very important question. I'm going to start off with an analogy that I use, or a metaphor I use with my presentations. Constellations. You can look at the night sky and you can see Scorpio. You can see the Big Dipper. You can see Orion. I think everybody kind of should know what Orion is in the sky, right? When you look at it. If you're in other cultures, you don't call it Orion. You might call it something else. But we all see that constellation. And in the Western culture, we call it Orion. There's no such thing as a constellation. They don't exist. It's something we impose on the night sky because that's what we think we see. And so we're looking at the night sky like a two-dimensional plane, that has north and south and east and west kind of plane. But space in the universe is three-dimensional at least. You know, physicists might tell you it's five or six or seven dimensions or whatever you want to call it. But it's not two-dimensional. And so if we get in a rocket ship going at the speed of light or faster than the speed of light, let's say it's Star Trek, right? And we head out into space 100 light years. Guess what? Orion kind of starts to look different. Then we go another 100 light years. And all of a sudden, it's like squished on its side. And then you go another 100 light years, and all of a sudden, there's no Orion. Because it never existed. Mm-hmm. It's something we thought we saw because of our two-dimensional vantage point on Earth. I tell people that language is like constellations. What you think you see in language is what you think you see, but that's not what language is. What people put in textbooks is there because you cannot describe language in textbooks. You can't. So I'm going to give a really simple example for your listeners. And if you want me to give more examples, I'm happy to jump in. Okay. I'm going to do one in English because you probably have listeners who speak all kinds of languages. And so English is going to be our common language today. So everybody agrees that there are subject and object pronouns, right? So subject pronouns are I, you, he, she, we, they, and so on. And the object pronouns are me, you, him, her, us, them, and so on, right? Okay, great. But here's two things. First of all, what is the definition of a pronoun? Everybody says, well, it's something that stands in place of a noun, right? So I'm talking about Claudia. And so I use she to talk about Claudia. That's a subject pronoun. It stands in for Claudia or the girl or the woman, right? Okay. But then I'm going to ask you the following question. If I use the pronoun I or me, what does it stand in for? There's nothing in a sentence before, because I don't talk about myself in the third person. I don't talk about myself as Bill and then switch to I and me. No, I and me are not pronouns the way he, she, they, him, her are. In fact, the only real pronouns in languages like English, if not all languages, are the third person pronouns. The other things are something different. So you have two different kinds of things working in language that are not equivalents. Now, how do we know this to be true? Because let's look at what we do in English. So I is a subject and me is an object, correct? Okay, so I can say like, I'm talking, right? And that's a subject. I cannot say, me, I'm talking. Right? It's wrong, right? Okay, so our little rule there, subjects and objects work. But now I'm going to say, Claudia and I are talking. But in English, and I can also say, Claudia and me are talking. Or me and Claudia are talking. Or I can say, she and I are talking. But I can also say in English, me and her are talking. And so the minute you start to look at how language actually works, you go, well, wait a minute, there's this division between subjects and objects isn't so clear after all. So what's really in someone's head? What's in someone's head is not some chart of I, you, he, she, it, we, they, and then me, you, him, her, it, us, them. That chart doesn't exist in anybody's head. The idea of subject and object pronouns like that don't exist in somebody's head. We have very abstract and complex stuff in our head that governs these things that are I, me, you, they, he, she, and so on, whatever you want to call them, right? So that's a very simple example of how what's on the page of a textbook, or if you Google something, it's illusory. It's like a constellation. We're looking at something because we don't have the words to describe what it really is. And we're looking at it in a two-dimensional way as opposed to the complexity, the multidimensional aspect of what language is. I can give more examples even. I thought that would be a simple one to give today.
Absolutely agree. And I remember many moments where I have these clever students that ask the question that I cannot answer, right? Like, especially with using the verb estar in Español, in the predicate and the imperfect, you know, and we have all this rule and we have all this acronym and we have, you know, even songs to explain all the rules. I mean, we have it all. We have the PowerPoints and we have all the explanations, and I used to do it a lot. And then I had a student who said, like, oh, but if you're saying that you use a star in the imperfect tense for, you're using imperfect tense for a location and weather and condition, and then when are you going to use the star for the predicate tense? And I was like, oh, I don't. So you never said yo estuve en el hotel because it's location. So it should be imperfect. So it should be estaba. And I was like, yeah, okay, very complicated. It just doesn't sound right. And it was, and I think we as language teachers, every single language teacher have had a student who have been clever enough to ask you the question that we just don't know how to answer. Right. No matter how good of a grammar we say that we have, we just don't have the answers. And then, and that was a thing for me was so important, is that when I was listening to your podcast, my kids was developing the language. So I could see my children talking to me in Spanish, learning from me, listening to me, and just reading my little books without any type of grammar instruction or, you know, nothing. And they were using subjunctive, and sometimes they mess it up many times because they were just developing. So I totally understand the complexity of the nature of language. I can't explain it. It's just so difficult that I just cannot. But then we have the question, and is, so what is the subject of our classes? Because if language cannot be explain with all these rules, I'm just saying, so what is the subject? So if I say Spanish class, is my subject Spanish or learning about Spanish? Or French class, what is the subject of a French class? Because in math, it's easy, right? Like in math, it's easy. In biology, it's easy. They explain all the biology theories. But so when teachers ask that question, so what am I supposed to be teaching? What can we answer?
I always answer this way. If you've ever raised a child or interacted with a child, you don't teach language to that child, but the child acquires language. So what is it you do that the child learns language? You interact with the child. So, and the child interacts with you, and the child interacts with the environment. So we shouldn't be teaching language anymore. We shouldn't be talking about, teaching should be a word we throw out. I'm going to just say, I'm not convinced in education more broadly, Claudia, about the teaching of math and the teaching of science and the teaching of history. I'm not convinced that those things get taught and learned the way people think they are. But that's their problem. Let them worry about it. I'm a linguist. I'm going to worry about language. So we need to get rid of the word teaching and say our classes aren't about teaching anything more if we're about acquisition. Our classes are about interaction and content that we want to talk about, right? So you can still have a Spanish class or a French class or a Russian class, but if your goal is communication and your goal is acquisition, those two things, because they go hand in hand, then you have to say, okay, I'm no longer a teacher, I'm something else, right? And it's hard to put that into words. It's hard to tell people what that is. But you've got to stop thinking of languages as just another subject matter. Because the minute you do that, you fall in the trap of following all the educational guidelines for science and math and history. All the things they tell you in schools of education about you must do this, you must do that, or national organizations or standards or this and that, most of which really don't speak to language acquisition at all. They just don't, right? But again, let's just be clear about one thing. You can teach Spanish as a subject. You can. I can go in with a textbook and teach out of a textbook. But I don't want anybody to think that that means my students are acquiring language. They might incidentally acquire some things because we're not always completely focused on the textbook, right? But anybody who thinks that teaching out of the textbook and practicing out of the textbook is language acquisition is fooling herself or fooling himself. And so we got to get out of that idea of the word teach and teaching. I don't have any good, people used to call in my show and ask me that question. I don't have a good answer for that. But
I totally agree. And I think one of the clarities that we have to have in our field is what is our goal? Because I think when we have clarity on our goal, we can select the strategies that are going to help us achieve that goal. And if that goal is acquisition and communication, then we just need to make some decisions. And if our goal is for our students to conjugate the verbs correctly and put the accent mark, because it's fascinating. I mean, like, I just know that I have students, and for me, explaining that, you know, the rule of affirmative commands, that you attach the pronoun to the command and add an accent mark on the third syllables counting. I mean, that is just makes you feel like, I don't know, very smart, I guess. But if that is the goal, then our strategies are going to be different. And I think that teaching part is really difficult for us as teachers to like kind of grasp. And I remember reading your book while we're on the topic, and I circled this quote from you, and I kept thinking about it for days, and I kept going on. And you said, I'm just so obsessed. I mean, like, I'm really obsessed with the topic. So you said in this, I'm going to just try to find it here. Oh my gosh. Okay, I got it. Language acquisition is slow, piecemeal, and stage-like, and follows a path not dictated by instruction or external forces. And at that point, I was like, oh my goodness, because you're saying it's not dictated by instruction or external forces. So can you like give us more context about that statement, that quote that you had, because it really changed many things and made me question a lot of the things that I was doing in class or expecting more for my students to like produce in class.
Okay. Let's note one thing, first of all. Those of us who do research in second language acquisition don't always rely and don't like to use the way students talk in class or tests that teachers give or essays that teachers give, any of those things as data for looking at language acquisition. Because what learners do in those situations is not language-like, and it's not, it doesn't reveal what's actually unfolding in their head over time. Let me give you a good example. I first got started doing research back when I was an MA student. And you mentioned ser en estar before, or at least estar. And I was fascinated because I didn't understand until I got in language acquisition why my students weren't getting how ser en estar worked. It was seemed crystal clear to me, right? I've been using ser en estar my whole life, you know? And so it's like, yeah, I know you say this and you say that. And so I got involved in a grant with a friend of mine. I became a research assistant. And what I had to do was pull students out of class. We had 10 people who volunteered, and they would come to my office every 2 weeks, and I would have conversations with them. We'd do video description. They weren't in class, and I put them at ease, almost like a psychiatrist session, right? Put them at ease, make them feel good. And we started doing things in Spanish, and they didn't even know that basically they were like subjects. And what I found was, and we had a range of, at the 10 of students or learners who were classified by the teachers as really good and smart, knew all the rules. They're like the kids you're talking about, Claudia, who will ask you the rule about, you know, when do you use a preterite with estar? When do you say estuve, right? Okay, so we had students like that. We had students who went to class, but, you know, maybe got C's on their test. Or, you know, we had a full range of things. And then over the years, since I let me just come back to that research in a minute. Over the years since I did that research, was back in the 1980s, people have done tons of research on set and estar and how it's acquired. In and out of classrooms, with Chinese speakers learning Spanish, with, you know, this and that. I mean, different people learning Spanish, different contexts. And what we found is that when you get them out of the classroom and speaking spontaneously or more spontaneously, and you also give them particular kinds of probing things. We've got very good techniques now. They're called psycholinguistic techniques to find out what's in people's heads. They don't even know that's there. And what we find, for example, is that the first stage of getting sentenced out is just not to use a verb at all. Spontaneously, they do what little kids do. They do things like, Juan Alto.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they just don't put a verb in, right?
Yeah.
And so, and that coincides with a number of other things happening at the same time. For example, about the same time learners of Spanish are using what we call bare verbs. Mm-hmm. So they use come, toma, habla. For those of you who don't speak Spanish, I'm saying eat, drink, speak, vive, live, right? Okay. So, those verbs, even though they're called third person singular in Spanish, here's your language knowledge that comes in. They actually aren't. Oh. They are featureless verbs, which is why we use them for the third. Because notice all the other verbs have endings.
Yeah.
Tomo, tomas, tomamos, toman. In Spain, tomáis, right? and if you're in Uruguay, it might be tomás, right? Only toma has no ending. It has the verb ah, but the vowel vowel exists in tomas, tomamos, tomais, toma. The only place it doesn't exist is in tomo. Right? Uh-huh. That's because it got swallowed up by the O. That's a long story how that happened in evolution. So toma, these are called bare verbs because they have no features. So what do learners do in the early stages of getting verbs? They say Juan toma, but they say yo toma Coca-Cola.
Absolutely.
You know? They'll say oh yo vive un apartamento grande, right? And so what are those two things telling us right there? There's no ser or estar, Juan alto, and then you also get yo toma Coca-Cola, right? It's hard for me to, I still try to imitate learners at the beginning stage, but those stages have something in common. This learner is telling us that they're in an initial stage of, there's no tense. Because what is the function of set and estar in Spanish? To carry tense features and person number features, right? Mm-hmm. There's no meaning. There's no meaning in set and estar in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. Right? Just like verb be. If I
they're
say
not
John,
action. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
There's no meaning, right? They're there. They have a grammatical function and that's it. Whereas live, speak, mm-hmm. die, those all have meaning. We know what those verbs mean, right? And so when you say Juan Alto, you're showing me that your system has no tense yet and no person number yet. And then on the bare verbs, yo toma, yo vive, you're telling me you have no tense and no person number in your system yet. You've created a system in which, even though Spanish has tense and person numbers, it's not in your system yet. You've created what every child does early on, what every learner of any language does. The beginning of the system is tenseless and featureless. Then something happens. The second stage of getting set in the status, stage two, is ser comes in. And you start to get things like, okay, so Juan es alto, mm-hmm. right? But then you also get like Juan es enfermo instead of Juan está mm-hmm. enfermo, mm-hmm. okay? So what are learners doing there? They're telling you, okay, my system now has tense. I don't know what verbs to use. I don't, you know, but I put a verb in because I need to put tense in the sentence.
Yeah.
And that's when, guess you start to see, right? What's the first thing you see is then you see it about the same time. Vivo, yo vivo.
Mm-hmm.
Yo hablo, yo estudio. You start to see the yo forms of the verbs come in because they're marking tense on the verb. So now stage two is tense is coming in. We see it in two different parts of the grammar and happening simultaneously, but independently of each other. But they're not completely independent because it's tied to this idea of tense. Then there's other stages, go through set and style, and other stages of getting the verb forms and so on. So these are examples of how the mind creates language over time and how language evolves in your head.
Mm-hmm.
You don't learn it from the input or learn it from rules. What you do is your mind extracts data from input as it sees fit at a given point in time while it is trying to create language in your head.
It just blows my mind. It just blows my mind because we are so stubborn and we don't want to listen and we still say, but how can I get my students to conjugate the yo form correctly? And, you know, and in Spanish one, we spend hours with set and estar. And then, of course, for the test, they will perform and they will put the words there. But by 6 months, it's gone. And then we keep saying our students don't study enough. They need to study enough because we can control it. Like, we really can control that.
But Claudia, let's back up a little bit here. I'm sorry. I'm going to make a connection now to other subject matter because... this is why I say I'm not convinced about math and science and history and all that kind of stuff. The same thing teachers will lament in other classes, other, mm-hmm. other areas, the same thing. You know, we did these kinds of equations in math and they took the test and I gave them a final and I had to reteach it all. They didn't remember anything about those equations or trying to memorize dates in history or movements in history. What's that movement called? What was the time frame for that? You know? And then you forget it. You memorize it for a test and then you forget it. Right. And so when we give them, when we teach explicitly in Spanish and French and Russian and German and Korean or whatever, and then we test them explicitly, we're setting ourselves up for failure the same way math teachers and science teachers and mm-hmm. history teachers are because students are students. Start thinking of them as learners, and you might see the world a little differently.
Yeah.
But right now, what we're doing is we're teaching those kids in our Spanish classes, we're looking at them as students and not learners of a language.
I agree with that. And I got an email 2 days ago from a teacher, and I knew that I was going to have this conversation. And it's like, I'm not going to respond to that email after I have this conversation with you. So I have more meat to answer to that question. And it was from a teacher, Spanish teacher, and she said, I am really trying to, and we go back to what you said at the beginning. It's like, we keep saying, I'm teaching with comprehensible input. So she said, I'm using a lot of comprehensible input in my class. We have a lot of conversations in L2, in L2, and then we have read a couple of readers, but my students are not making progress. And I am assuming that she's saying that her students are not making progress because of the production, right? Like, I think that when they sit down and produce language, then they don't see, or the teacher doesn't see that. So there is a lot of frustration from a lot of teachers who are trying to walk away from that grammar teaching and vocab list. And somehow when you teach for the grammar and the vocab list and you do a lot of practice and a lot of drills, then students take a quiz or take a test. And for that given moment, they complete the test and conjugate the verbs. But then they don't see that when they start having these conversations in the target language, they start reading. And then you say, okay, now we talk about what you did that weekend. And we have talked about what you did that weekend for 3 weeks in a row. So you may now know that you can produce. So how can we support teachers who are in that stage where, yes, I understand that, you know, that teaching of grammar may not be the best, but I just don't see it that is happening for my students?
Yeah, I'm trying to peel. This sounds like an onion with lots of layers in there. The teachers are so used to looking at grammatical development and vocabulary development, quantifiable things. And they don't know how to look at language developmentally. And they see everything in terms of production, but accurate production. So my guess is they're looking for and at the wrong things. My guess is that they haven't noticed the student sentences are getting longer than they were a year before. They're not noticing that the learners have a lot more words, productive words, than ever before. And not only that, but they have a lot more receptive words. So that ties to another thing. They haven't noticed that their learners struggled to read this paragraph in September, but now in May, they can read that paragraph with ease. There's all kinds of things they're just not looking at because they're not thinking about acquisition or communication. They're thinking about textbook language and and standardized education, the way we measure things. So we need to start, thinking about what, I mean, nobody in child language acquisition research, or a parent for that matter, doesn't even do the research, thinks about these kinds of things that teachers think about in language classes. They just don't. And so, for example, for the longest time, in child language acquisition, they still talk about this, in introductory books on child language acquisition, that children go from a babbling stage to a, one word stage to a two word stage, and so on. And they chart this progress over, like, you know, two and a half to 3 years. And so they look at development and growth quite differently. They don't look at, are they using the past tense now when they're 2.5 years old? They're not looking at that. They're looking at other measurements because all that other stuff they know is going to take care of itself, right? And then they also do some very sophisticated things where they look at receptive ability with children. So, for example, with babies, they've got these devices, you know, little chupetes. What do you call those in English? You put them in your mouth. Hooked to an electric wire. And they go to this machine. And what they do is they do things to the baby with sounds and so on. And based on how the baby sucks, they can tell if a baby is recognizing sounds or not, even though the baby can't produce sounds. So they're looking at what's in the child's head, even though it's not coming out of the mouth. So teachers aren't looking at what's going on in their heads. This is one thing I don't like about the proficiency movement. Like when oral proficiency took off in the 80s and we had all this oral proficiency tests and so on, people got so hung up on speaking and making their students talk. They forgot that first you got to get language in your head before you can talk.
Yeah,
absolutely. And talking is going to evolve over time, but language has to get in your head first, right? And so we need to start thinking about development in other ways, right? Not the standard ways or the traditional ways.
Absolutely. And I think that when we start really measuring the language development of our students in a different way, that is not the traditional way, will be much more rewarding for us as teacher and less frustrating also for our students who are going to see their growth. And that is going to change, as you mentioned it, the questions that they ask about, is this going to be in our test? So thank you so much for this first part of the conversation, Dr. Vilben Patany. Has been incredibly insightful for me, and I know that for all the listeners. And for you, if you're listening to this, thank you so much for taking the time to tune in and listen to this incredible conversation. And just get ready for the second part, where we're going to talk about something that I know you want to listen, and it's about the role of grammar and also the role of output in language acquisition. Thank you again for listening. I hope that you have a great week. And remember, if you're loving this episode or this podcast, I would love for you to write us a review in Apple Podcasts or share with your friends, share with other French teachers who may be interested in this podcast. Thank you so much again. Muchas gracias y nos vemos pronto. Bye bye.